Hi there. My name's Ryan Bernstein, and this is 50 States of Mind, a cross-country journey to all 50 states to talk to mayors, governors, and voters on both sides of the aisle to figure out what's really going on in the United States. I'll be honest, when I started this trip, I wasn't optimistic about the state of our country. But after visiting our neighborhoods, towns, and communities, I've been given an exciting education that has allowed me to listen, challenge my preconceived notions, and taught me something new. Are you ready? Let's go. All right, this is 50 States of Mind. We have made it to the heartland of America, and we have a very, very, very special guest with us today. What's your name, young lady?
Nancy.
Nancy. Where do you come from?
I come from Glasgow in Scotland.
Does everyone in Scotland have red hair, or is it just you?
Mainly. If they don't, they usually dye the hair red.
Actually?
To fit in. Yeah, mainly, yeah.
Is your hair naturally red?
Mine is, yeah. I'm lucky, so I've saved a lot of money at the hair salons in Glasgow.
Wow. So what is the vibe of Glasgow?
Well, I suppose the kind of big rivalry is with Edinburgh, because they're the two biggest cities. Having said that, Glasgow is bigger than Edinburgh, and it does have a bit more of a city feel to it. I think Glasgow, you know, there's a bit of a stronger community there because more people are sort of from Glasgow or have a kind of family connection. Mm-hmm. In Edinburgh, it's a little bit more transient. A lot of people come up for university or come up from England or other countries and stay for a few years and then kind of move on. So, you know, it's a little bit more transient. I think in Glasgow, the people are very sort of friendly. They're quite chatty.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to the United States?
I have been, yeah. I've done a couple of big road trips there and then just been over skiing a couple of times and also visited LA and New York a long time ago.
What was your favourite place you visited?
I love New York. I love all Tennessee, and, you know, did a big road trip down sort of from Chicago right down south to New Orleans, and that was fantastic. Just, I love all those southern states and music, like Mississippi, places like that. I think the main thing, though, with the states is just how diverse it is. As soon as you cross a state border, it's completely different. I like that kind of patchwork that it is. I like Detroit a lot when we were there. That wasn't what I expected it to be. And
when were you there?
Probably about 9-10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah. So it wasn't quite on the upswing yet?
No, not at all. It was like you were actively advised not to go. Or you could be murdered or something. So, no.
Is there any place in the UK that's like that, where you're advised not to go because you'll be murdered?
Well, Glasgow.
Really?
Yeah. You were always advised not to go to Glasgow.
I automatically think of the UK as safer because there aren't really guns. Are there guns?
Not very many, I don't think.
In Glasgow, you get what? Shanked?
You get knifed. In Glasgow, we prefer to knife people.
I feel like the logistics.
Or a doing. You might get a doing. Do you know what a doing is?
No. What is a doing?
It's just when people batter you and they start punching you and kicking you. Yeah.
A doing.
Give you a doing.
Does that happen a lot?
I remember when I was a teenager, there were quite a lot of doings to different extents. You know, some kind of minor, some a bit more serious. But now I believe knives are a wee bit more popular, but it's not a culture I'm particularly embedded in Glasgow.
Really?
Yeah, really.
You seem like the queen of the doings. A knifing seems a little lazy compared to a doing. Like a doing, you really have to put in a lot of effort. A knife is just, but also the logistics of having a knife, it's kind of tricky. Is it like a pocket knife or is it I'm picturing a kitchen knife, but actually...
Any kind of knife. I think some people carry machetes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, machete. But that's like your serious making a mark knifer. I think
there are people walking around Glasgow carrying machetes.
Yeah, well, this was my experience when I was on jury duty, and you know, and also you're called for jury duty and you're hearing charges, and certainly there was a wee bit of kind of machete carrying going on. But I'd say that's a rarity.
Ranking them from most personal to least personal, I think a doing is the most personal because you actually have to engage with that person. Then a knifing, because you're still actually like sticking it, and then you're making contact, and then just shooting. Shooting is very impersonal. You can do it from a car, but there's no physical contact. I think a doing is the best way to engage with your community.
Yeah, and a doing's a wee bit fairer too, because it gives the other person chance to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's a bit just shooting people. It's a wee bit cowardly.
Is there like a school of doings?
No, I mean, there's kind of mainstream education, and then... You know, that would be something you might pick up on an ad hoc basis, a need to know basis. You know, obviously, if somebody gave you a doing, you might then be interested in learning how to give them a doing, and you take it from there. It's a survival skill, I would say.
You know, I've never been in a fight.
Have you not?
Ever.
You're joking.
If anyone deserves to be punched, it's me, but no one's ever done it.
Has anyone shot you? Have you seen any shootings?
Actually, the only time I've seen a dead person like on the ground who'd been shot in Chicago on the south side. I was down there doing community service and I saw that. But I have not seen any stabbings, nor have I been stabbed.
Do you not?
Have you ever seen a stabbing?
No. I've seen a shooting.
Where? Yeah.
Canada.
In Canada?
In Canada. And my understanding of Canada was people sort of prided themselves on being non-gun carrying.
Interesting. So, do you have any questions about America that you've always wanted to ask but never had a charming, willing American to ask?
Do you think Donald Trump will be re-elected for a second term?
On one hand, I think no, because I think people are just tired of all the tomfoolery that he's put out there, just all the constant drama. But I also think we're a little addicted to it. I think we kind of like it. When we watched the presidential debate the other night, one of my friends was like, it's kind of boring. I miss Trump. I think we kind of like the reality show aspect of him. ISIS is no longer an issue, and I think you can point to that. You can say that the economy is doing well because of the tax cuts. You can say North Korea is not a problem. I think there's an argument to be made. But on the other hand, I think the Democrats, specifically people like Elizabeth Warren, have plans to actually help Americans with the things that they're most concerned about, which is, I think, income inequality and healthcare. But that being said, watching the debates, it worries me a little bit when they raise their hands and talk about giving healthcare to illegal immigrants, which I think is probably a good thing for a public health standpoint. I think it might scare some people off. So I don't know. It really kind of depends how the whole thing shakes out. But yeah, I think people are weirdly kind of addicted to Trump. What do you think?
I don't think anybody in the UK is enormously impressed with him. But when I was in the States in February, I was speaking to a guy who was a Trump voter, and I could understand why he was. He was saying he didn't like the way that Trump phrased things, but he kind of agreed with the principles in that before Trump, he was struggling about getting work and things, you know, and he felt that Trump more represented people like him who work.
Trump, the billionaire from New York, represented people in the middle of the country. It's just something I can never get over, but that's why politics is so fascinating, because it makes no sense, especially American politics. It's something that is so high stakes, but it's so built on stories and narratives and almost myths. It's like our Shakespearean dramas playing out in front of us on our news screens.
Yeah, and I guess, like, Trump's sort of good for a soundbite. Like, not all of them are things that America can take pride in, but he's got something to say. I don't know. I mean, I find it strange that you have a president who was kind of, you know, to my mind, was known for being on The Apprentice. You know, it just seems a strange kind of transition that you go from something that is basically reality television completely staged to more sort of staged reality television, and yet you're making decisions that have an impact across the whole world.
Yeah. I read in an article that Trump, when he started his administration, said, I want you to think of every day as an episode of a reality show. But I think he's he's tapped into something that is really true. Americans do consume our country's decisions in that way. We consume it as entertainment. And I think Trump is really good in making it entertainment. It's the same way that we kind of love to be horrified by reality TV shows. I think deep down, maybe some of us enjoy just that there's something every day that Trump has done, something new for us to be outraged at or to talk about or debate about or to tweet about or something. And
yeah, it's interesting, though, that he has just tapped into that, you know, everybody's got a TV in the home. And if you kind of break down your message so that it's just kind of bite size, easily consumed, you can reach a lot of people and you can sort of speak to them in a kind of voice and means that they're used to. And, you know, he has that kind of larger-than-life sort of image, which I guess translates quite well into those wee snapshots on the television. You know, he doesn't strike me as a big thinker or a man for detail, but, yeah, I mean, hopefully he doesn't intervene as much as some of the past American governments have done with foreign policy, but I'm not a huge fan of his kind of wall-building policy.
Mm. Well, on that note, the state that I'm going to give you is a state that actually usually voted for Democrats, but in 2016, it flipped by a thin margin for Trump.
Right.
It's a state in the Midwest. It's actually, I realize, a state that you've been to. Nancy, what do you know about the state of Michigan?
I've been there, so that's kind of helpful.
Yeah.
I first kind of heard about it when we were in Canada, in Windsor.
Yeah.
Yeah, just kind of, I didn't realise this in my ignorance, but just kind of at the other side of the river from Detroit. We came to the border and needed some directions, so we kind of stopped for coffee, went into a few places and asked how you got to Detroit, and nobody knew, nobody had been that we'd spoken to, right? So I was kind of surprised because it didn't look very far away on the map. But the reason nobody had been there was because they thought it was too dangerous to visit. So eventually I went into the tourist information in Windsor and met a guy there, and he had actually been, which presumably was why he was working at tourist information, but he'd not stayed for very long. He'd just gone for a weekend. He'd been with friends, so he'd felt a little bit safer.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us that you could either go by a tunnel or over a bridge. And at that point, I kind of started realising that all the big high buildings that we could see at the other side of the river were not, in fact, the other half of Windsor. They were Detroit. So we went through the tunnel, came up in the centre, and we had a hire car which we'd picked up in the States. So it had New York plates on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going round this roundabout in circles trying to find how to turn off to go to Motown. And this guy who looked a bit kind of like Puff Daddy, but had like loads of bling on, kind of big gold medallions and everything. And he had a gun as well. He had a gun kind of his glove box. He pulled over and started being like, "Hey, New York!" And kind of just shouting and swearing at us. And I didn't know who he was talking to at first because I didn't think of myself as a New Yorker. And then Paul, my partner, kind of pointed out that we had these New York plates. So he was really angry, this guy. And I was a bit worried after all the word we'd had from Windsor that we were going to be shot or at least have our tyres shot, because he was really annoyed at the way we were going round the roundabout nonstop. I kind of held out my Lonely Planet book as a peace offering and asked him some directions to Motown. Then he was kind of like, "Hey, you from England?" And we're kind of like, Scotland. And he's like, "I've heard of that place." So I think he thought it was kind of near London. and he'd heard of London. So after that, he just turned super helpful. The whole like tire shooting was completely forgotten. And he gave his directions to Motown. And the brilliant thing about Detroit was no traffic at all. Nobody there. So, or not at that point, just nobody. So we basically straight down the road, hung a right, you know, just totally empty streets and pulled up outside Motown. And it was when Michael Jackson had just died.
Oh, yeah.
So the States were kind of in this mourning period and people were just kind of playing Michael Jackson songs around the clock. And there were all kind of flowers out the front of Motown for Michael Jackson and teddy bears and messages and stuff like that. And we went just straight in. It couldn't have been easier. There's no queue in. There's hardly anybody going around it. And my daughter was about one at the time, I think, nearly two. And at one point she kind of ran off and started playing this piano, and then we realised, like it said, please do not touch. And this tour guide, and the tour guide was very relaxed about it. He's like, don't worry. And it was the piano that Stevie Wonder learned to play on, and it still had like little dots, like coloured dots on it to show which fingers to play different keys with. And they had the kind of sofa that Marvin Gaye used to lie on. So, yeah, so that was our favourite, really, Detroit. It was just one of our favourite cities because its reputation was so, so far off the mark. And also because of its kind of reputation, there was nobody there. So you could just kind of go about everything without the inconvenience of being part of a large tour group. So
that's honestly one of my favorite stories, and if there's a 50 States of Mind moment, it's you and the guy screaming at you, hey, New York, turning super helpful and friendly once he realizes you're from somewhere else. It's yeah, that's really exciting. I mean, it's cool that you were able to experience Detroit. That's what's cool about you not going to New York or LA, where they're so used to people coming in and from all over the world. You got to go somewhere where it's, that's probably cool for Detroit to have you there. Yeah. Well, so the first interview we're going to be listening to is about as far away from Detroit as possible. Michigan has what's called the UP, the Upper Peninsula. They call the people who live up there Upers. So Michigan is shaped like a mitten. Nice. Then it also has this sort of upper part that goes above Lake Michigan up here, and they're connected by a big bridge. So I decided, instead of just driving from Wisconsin over through Illinois and Indiana to Michigan, I was going to drive all the way up through Wisconsin, okay, go to the northern part, and then drive through the UP, which is small little villages. And it really has a lot of tourists in the summer. I think a lot of people have summer homes there, but I ended up going the winter. So it was about to start storming, and I was kind of trying to get a move on, but I needed lunch. So I stopped at this roadside diner and motel, and I started talking to the waitress about what it was like to live in the UP. This is my first interview with Marie, who is a lifelong Uper.
Have you ever been so busy that you were like, I wish I had an intern? I've been there, between grad school and driving to all 50 states. Well, thanks to GenM, now you can. GenM offers you an apprentice for 90 days to help with your business. No matter if it's a startup or a podcast, you can search for apprentices based on skills, languages, and countries, and swipe through countless options to find the perfect person to help you grow your business. I'm such a fan of my apprentice that I'm offering everyone who signs up $10 off for clicking the link in the bio of the episode. So what are you waiting for? Start looking for a teammate today. What's your name, and Marie, what do you do here in Michigan?
My name's Marie, and I'm just a waitress right now. I got my corrections degree after high school. Went to be a corrections officer, but they put a freeze on all the hiring same year, so I never did that. I might still do it, I don't know, but I make pretty good money waitressing, so.
Yeah, and what do you feel like is the primary difference between life in the UP and life in the rest of Michigan?
I mean, it is beautiful, don't get me wrong, but living up here is very hard. very hard living up here.
What makes it so hard?
Well, employment. There's hardly any, like, if you're not, like, at the hospital or the corrections or, you know, at the Sioux Locks or something, you're not, there's really nothing. Just heading up US-2, you're going to notice a lot of businesses closed for the winter. Right. We're open year-round here, which is another reason why I'm staying here, because, you know, because a lot of people have to go on unemployment for the winter. And unemployment, they make it so difficult to even get your unemployment going. Plus, the bills go up in the winter, too. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's definitely hard living. It's beautiful up here. Winters are long. But, no, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I really wouldn't. I would rather live here than anywhere else in Michigan, I think.
How would you describe the culture politically? Do people lean one way or another, or do people not really talk about politics?
Yeah, that's a touchy one. That is a touchy one. People, because it's so hard living up here, too, we want to see change and the right change and stuff. So I've been in many, like, we've talked, there was a gentleman in here last summer talking about Trump. He hates Trump. I love Trump. Absolutely love Trump. I'm, like, just loving what he's doing for our country. And he's, like, and it was, like, almost a full-blown arc. I literally had to change the subject and walk away.
Well, so, while you were...
While I was working.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. Because he was asking me if I liked Trump or whatever. I can't remember how it started, but it almost turned into, like, a full-blown argument, so I had to stop it. But, yeah. A lot of Trump supporters up here, absolutely, but the ones that aren't, absolutely hate him. But, yeah. So, it's a pretty touchy subject. Absolutely.
So, people don't really talk about it because it can kind of escalate.
Well, there's some people that just don't care either, you know. There's some people that come in, they don't care. They're going to state their opinion. That's how it is. And it's like, okay, so you just agree and walk away so you don't get into an argument. But, yeah, I'd say politics is pretty touchy. That's, mm-hmm. That's, yeah, for sure.
And do you feel like is there a real sense of community up here on the UP?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Absolutely.
Like, you know your neighbors and... Mm-hmm.
Everybody around here knows everybody else. For instance, there's an old couple that lives right up the road, and her husband was in the hospital the other day. Fluid on his lungs. He's in his 80s. She called up here, and her driveway was blown in, so we had the boss's boyfriend went over and shoveled her driveway for her before they came home from the hospital. Like, everybody around here knows everybody else, and we're always looking out for each other, especially if somebody's in a bind.
What'd you think of that?
It doesn't totally surprised me, only because, you know, as I was saying earlier, like, it was in the States in February, and when you're speaking to people who are just trying to make a living, and, you know, the work is perhaps not all that stable. And for all, I was in Colorado when I was there in February, but again, you're at a place where there's a lot of skiing in the winter. In the summer, there's mountain biking and different activities, so, you know, the work is a bit seasonal. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't completely surprise me, like, hearing Marie talking about why she loves Trump, because I think his policies are perhaps a bit more directed on workers in America. It always sort of surprises me how big a consideration healthcare is in the States, because I'm fortunate sort of living in a country where it's not something you have to factor in as much into your plans. You know, it's something we maybe take for granted here with the NHS. And obviously that's not the case in the States. You know, you're having to think about how you're going to pay for healthcare, and that's a big thing.
Okay, so the next place I went was... East Lansing. I went to go visit a friend, and he said, I have this teacher there that changed my life, an incredible guy. And he's the drama teacher, and I think teaches a civics class at the high school. And what he does is, instead of putting on a play like Mamma Mia or something, he will have the students write their own pieces. So either a political satire that they have to write about their community or politics in America, or he'll have students write their own material. So someone will write a piece about, you know, an eating disorder and then perform it in front of their peers. Or they'll write something about struggles with their parents and then perform it for the parents at the school. So he kind of had this really interesting point of view about what the role of theater is for young people as a way of expression, not just through performing, but also through sort of sorting through their own experiences. So here he is.
Are they making fun of themselves when they write the sketches, or the other side that they now understand better?
No, both.
Both, yeah.
No, that's part of it, is the whole concept of laughing at oneself, you know what I mean? To fully understand who they are and what they're about. So I know it always starts with that, the laugh with self, and then it lends to further dialogue and conversation that helps with the understanding, and then we always, you know, what I call sort of the broader connections, and when we sort of back it away. So it always starts with self, and then it says, or then we talk about how does it impact your community, your own family, or your circle of friends. Back it up further. How does it impact the region or your community? And I let them sort of define their own community. A community could be an age range. It could be the community of DeWitt. It could be, you know, a particular, you know, their class, maybe a junior class or whatever. So they define their community. Then we back it up further and say, okay, what's going on regionally? What's going on at the state level, domestically? And then what's going on at the global level? And then after those stages, the final stage is, okay, that they're all connected. And as a result of that further research and inquiry, you need to apply what it is that you've discovered. So it's all about sort of that exploratory learning, research, and making connections, connecting the dots when it's all said and done.
So kids are showing up for performing arts, and it actually sort of becomes performing arts and civics.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels pretty unique. Yeah. I feel like a lot of high schools don't think of it that way. When did you start trying to make kids think beyond just let's perform a musical?
I would say sort of from day one. I mean, I'm not interested in just doing what's in front of you. You know what I mean? I want it to be a psychological study of the mind, of the universal language of laughter, of timing, a sense of chemistry, a sense of community, a sense of, you know, much larger picture. I'm not interested in, you know, putting on a play. I never really was. I'm interested in sort of changing and saving lives, and how we do that is by giving it to them.
Okay, Nancy, as an educator, what do you think?
I totally agree with what he's saying. I like the way he's sort of recognised the importance of children and adults sort of understanding themselves. And actually, if you want to change things, you first of all have to understand yourself and have an insight into yourself and change those things. I think there's a very interesting sort of state of denial that's associated with political change, you know, that I think people invest an awful lot of time into thinking, right, if I change the government, that is going to change my life. When in fact, I think if you possibly sort of changed your own or worked on the things that are making your own life difficult as much as you possibly can, that's going to have a kind of bigger impact, because I think there's a limit to what governments do. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I also do think it's really important that unfair policies are addressed. I think that's something that you can expect, and sometimes it's not delivered on by governments and by leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But I think sometimes we put too much energy in trying to kind of change political systems and, you know, just fighting to change governments, and when a lot of time is kind of wasted that we could have invested in kind of changing ourselves. So I think it's really interesting and useful work that he's doing in making children reflect on things that they can control, such as their own dealings with people and their own relationships, but also how that interlinks with every other aspect of their life and how their behaviour kind of will affect relationships within their home and within their community. And that then when you place these on a sort of national or international platform, mm-hmm. which obviously we see politicians doing all the time, then the impact's far greater. And, you know, we see quite a lot of politicians that appear to lack any kind of self-awareness and yet are making sort of decisions that affect millions and millions of people around the world. So, yeah, great. You know, it'd be good if there were more people doing that kind of work.
Yeah. And one thing I love about what he thinks of himself as is he's like, I don't think of myself as a teacher, because that sort of insinuates that I have all the answers. I think of myself as a talent developer. Kids mm-hmm. come in and they sort of already have the raw material to become something, and I'm going to sort of help them become whatever version of their highest potential is. That's great. I didn't get any interviews in Detroit, but I went to Ann Arbor, which is where University of Michigan is, and I met someone who was the public health director in Detroit, during the Flint, Michigan water crisis. He then became candidate for governor in Michigan, and he lost the primary, but he is the first, one of the first Muslim candidates for governor in the United States. His name is Abdul, and he actually went to University of Oxford.
Oh, okay.
So here he is.
Talk to me about the beginnings of your gubernatorial campaign and the process of running for governor. Was that something you had ever thought you wanted to do?
Everybody, a lot of people have told me I should run for office. Mm-hmm. The first person that actually told me I should run for office was at my college commencement here in Michigan in 2007. I was the speaker, and the main speaker was Bill Clinton. And you know, he told me I should run for office, and I, you know, looked at him and I was like, Mr. President, I appreciate you saying that, but I've got 11 letters in my first name. People like me don't get to run for office. Mm-hmm. That was, of course, a year before Obama.
Game changer.
A game changer. First time I ever saw myself as a politician. And, you know, I was sort of watching as I'm rebuilding a department shut down by emergency management, watching the water crisis happen, and watching Donald Trump get elected president, and asking myself what my responsibilities are.
Yes.
And that's when I decided to run. Now, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I had never run for office before.
So the health director is an appointed?
It's an appointed role. The good news, though, is that I had spent enough time around politics to understand sort of what the nature of the undertaking might be. And, you know, started engaging people, telling them I'm going to run for office. And most of the people who actually knew what they were talking were like about said, you know, you might actually have a shot at this just because of your story. And, you know, you've got a natural ability to talk to people. And, so I started talking to folks, and soon enough, you know, looked for people who knew more about this than I did, right? I think a lot of folks in leadership positions try and surround themselves by people who don't know as much as they do. I've always tried to surround myself by people who know more than I do and put them in positions to thrive. And that's exactly what we did. Built an incredible team, I think one of the best teams in politics, and I think one of the strongest campaigns in national politics for 20 years.
So Bernie Sanders came in, so that's his big claim to fame. What do you think of Dr. Abdul?
I liked what he was saying about surrounding himself with people that sort of know more than him. Like, I always think that's, well, something that's advisable to do in life. You know, I mean, that's how you learn, and that's how you end up with a better organization, you know, where there's a little bit less ego and a bit more letting other people kind of shine. I mean, he was talking a lot about running for office, and I don't think, as somebody British, like, I completely understand what that is in the States. I don't fully understand the political structure. And so what's involved with him running for office at that level?
So running for governor of a state is like, so governor is what Bill Clinton was a governor, Ronald Reagan was a governor. It's basically you're the president of a state. And so he ran for governor as a Democrat, but he lost the Democratic primary to Gretchen Whitmer, who ended up becoming the governor of Michigan. But he kind of was one of the big progressive candidates in 2018 who got an endorsement of Bernie Sanders, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out to stump for him as well. So,
and what is he doing when he's running for office?
So you're going to doing campaign rallies, you're meeting with different constituencies, unions, different voting groups, doing news segments, doing interviews. So yeah, that's about all I have for Michigan. Is there anything else you want to talk about Glasgow or your travels or doings?
No, I've forgotten about doings. I know, it just shows how much society's changed, that even violence has become less personal.
Yeah, violence has become less personal. Everything's on social media now. We don't have the courage to have political discussions in person. We don't have the courage to knife someone in person anymore. It's all shooting someone from a car with a gun. It's all tweeting something mean at someone. When will we get back to the principles?
Ah, yeah, that kind of personal engagement.
And
being seen, like, you know, that the violence is more visible.
I think we figured out how to make society better.
Yeah. And did you find, like, as somebody from the Midwest yourself, by the time you'd been around all the states, Did you still think the Midwest was the best?
Yes.
Did you?
I love the United States. I love all the states I've gone to. It's unbelievably beautiful, especially the West, but it's almost too beautiful for me to deserve it. You know, I'm just like, I don't deserve how beautiful this is, but there's something about the Midwest that I just adore. I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm from there, but going to Detroit, Chicago, Oklahoma City, Kansas City, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Indianapolis, Sioux City, like all the Midwest cities, I really have an affinity for, because they're all a lot like Detroit, where they just have beautiful historic architecture because they're really starting to get built up during the 1920s.
Right.
They've got some nice industry, but it's also inexpensive and people are nice. And yeah, there's just something about the Midwest that I'm moving back to the Midwest. So I'm team Midwest through and through. But yeah, you'll have to come on visit. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Any last words?
No, I don't think so. It's too sunny.
Let's get outside and enjoy the last vestiges of summer here at Oxford. Well, Nancy, thank you so much. And I feel like there are more travel in store for both of us, both in the UK and abroad.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for coming on, and I hope we catch you doing. Get my first bite ever.
Yeah, well, I'll maybe step back a wee bit and let you experience the dune.
If you love this episode, take a second to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Writing positive reviews helps support the show, increases our chances of landing bigger guests, such as the 2020 presidential candidates, and helps us get the message out to as many people as possible. Want to further connect? Find us on our website, 50statesofmind.org, or on Instagram and Facebook, 50statesofmind. Thanks to Bright Moments for the theme song, the King's Hall Fund for a generous grant, and associate producer Mike Layer. Thanks for listening.